It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. When you're out in the wilderness, it can seem brand new. But Alaska has been explored many times by the indigenous people and starting in the late 19th century by some very hardy Americans who came north to investigate the science and geography of this new possession of the United States. Among them was John Muir, who paddled up the Inside Passage in a canoe to investigate glaciers and came later by boat. A new book is out about Muir's journeys, and we'll learn today about that work and other early American explorers and how they survived before Gore-Tex or Kevlar or any of the other modern materials that make it easy for wilderness expeditions today. And I've got two guests with me today, both of whom are extraordinary experts on this subject, and I think we're going to have a fascinating conversation about history and about these really rugged folks who explored Alaska when it was so much harder than it is now. I know we have some pretty amazing folks on the show all the time talking about their wilderness escapades, but my gosh, they didn't do what John Muir did. So in the studio with me right now is Talis Kohlberg, who is a historian. He's the director of the Mat-Su College, and he has a very strong knowledge of the expeditions of that period. Thanks for being with us, Talis.
You're welcome.
And on the line from Gustavus is Kim Haycox, who's a historian and author of 10 books. And his new book, which is just out, is called John Muir and the Ice That Started a Fire, How a Visionary and the Glaciers of Alaska Changed America. And this has been published by Lions Press. Thanks for being with us, Kim.
You're welcome, Charles.
So set the stage for us, Kim. I think John Muir's name is probably known to most people, but a lot of time has passed, and the significance of his writing and the ability of one man in that time period to explore and write and really change the nation is something truly unique, something that it was exceptional about him.
I think he came along at the perfect time. There was nobody else like him in America. At the time, he was born in the 1830s. He was born the same decade as John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie, who became very powerful industrialists. And during that same decade, we produced John Muir and, for example, John Burroughs, the great nature writer. And as America was moving westward and industrializing itself, I think the entire country began to have a bit of a crisis of conscience and say to itself, should we perhaps save pieces of the original America and hold on to them for future generations? And at the same time, then we purchased, 1867, the purchase of Alaska from Russia, and then Muir's great canoe journeys into Alaska just 12 and 13 years later, 1879 and 1880. And he basically, what John Muir did was give America a whole new vision of Alaska when Secretary of State William Seward purchased it for $7.2 million. The media called it Seward's icebox, Seward's folly. Why spend $7 million when the country's trying to reconstruct itself after a horrible civil war on Alaska, mm-hmm. after it's all used up by the Russians? And Muir comes up here and says it's a shimmering beauty. He's looking for glaciers, and he writes in the Overland Monthly and different newspapers.
And we think of him as being associated with Yosemite National Park, and that he was sort of the father of that park and California and the Sierra Club. But what you've brought out in the book is that Alaska was a core part of his legacy and of his message in his writing. It wasn't an afterthought.
Very much so, right. He came up to Alaska to prove his theories of glaciation in the mountains of California, because the leading geologists at the time said the Sierra Nevada, especially Yosemite Valley, had been created by catastrophic downfaulting, and Muir had hiked all over the mountains and said no, it was created by glaciers. So he came up to Alaska to help buttress those theories. He changed everything. He had a remarkable life, an amazing career. Don't you think, Talis?
I think he did a wonderful job in this book. It's beautiful, and just even when you talk about the boulder being found in California and his argument as with Whitney, I think you had the reference to him, that that you have the one section of the book where you say the least credentialed person on the Harriman expedition being Muir, but having the most to say. And that's always a conundrum when you know, people with really insights that lack an official credential, and then they get sidestepped. It's kind of like the debate between Richard Burton and John Speke in the great exploration of Africa, and Speke loses the argument officially because he's not as prominent, but he was actually more correct than Burton, and maybe commits suicide because of it.
Yeah. It's fascinating from our perspective to think that at the time that Muir was making these expeditions, this was a cutting edge of science. I mean, we now might think of space exploration, but or something that's done with a particle accelerator. But in fact, in those days, you could look at a valley and you didn't know what created it. And so you sort of come to Alaska and look at real glaciers and see how they're functioning, and use that knowledge to extrapolate to the Alps and to Yosemite and figure all that out. So, but Muir was not really, he was more of an outdoorsman than he was a scientist, wasn't he, Kim? He was somebody who grew up in a pretty rough rural way, and he loved the outdoors, and he liked to travel rough, and he came to Alaska not on a steamboat, but in a canoe.
Right. Yeah, he did like to travel rough. He did have a rough upbringing. He was born in Scotland, and then his family moved to Wisconsin in 1849 when he was 11 years old. He was harnessed behind a plow when he was, 10 or 12 by his father. He was the oldest son. His father worked him very hard. His father was a strict Calvinist, so Muir was raised with that kind of an upbringing. And the most significant thing that John Muir did in his life, I believe, was he walked away from his family and his home to reinvent himself. It's a hard thing. It's a very challenging thing to decide that, I think I've been indoctrinated in a certain way, and I'm going to go out into the world and let the world at large be my teacher, and I'll make up my own mind.
What a spirit he had, right? I mean, the spirit of adventure and discovery that was in this man was like, and in a way, that spirit plus the opportunity of the West to go out and explore it.
Exactly. And he's working in an Indianapolis carriage factory late at night. A file flips out of his eye, pierces the cornea out of his hand, pierces the cornea of his eye. The other eye goes blind in sympathetic shock. He takes a month to recover from blindness, decides to devote himself to the beauty of the natural world. So he had some profound moments in his life that he could have made a lot of money as an inventor, as a businessman. But he decided to devote himself to another path, and that's remarkable, really.
Mm-hmm. It is. So tell us, what is when you look at Muir within sort of the series of historical figures in Alaska and the Americanization of Alaska, is he a major part of that story of like Alaska becoming part of America?
Well, because of this book, he may now be. This is a book I can easily see being a permanent fixture in any tour of Alaska for the foreseeable future. The opening is just an instant reminder of how close we are in time to a very different world in Alaska. Going up the Inside Passage in a canoe, I had the privilege of knowing Walter Soboloff for almost half a century. He was my pastor as a child, and he lived to be 102 years old.
And for those who don't know, he was a very important Native leader of Southeast Alaska.
Right, and he was a correspondent with me until within a month of when he died, literally. And he once sent me a letter describing how his mother took a canoe as a Tlingit Indian in the Inside Passage to go to a meeting as a normal means of transportation. And I was always fascinated by the idea that here I was in touch with someone, even though he was quite old, who was just one generation removed for where that was normal. And so when I read this passage in the opening of Kim's book, I thought, this is so real, and this is just a reminder of how different transportation and movement was, and it has to be something that Muir just embraced with a gusto, because it was getting away from
going into the unknown,
modern technology. I mean, this was as simple as it gets. And one of my favorite Muir stories is when the High Sierras, he climbs the tree and sits through the windstorm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you have to wonder, was he a little off, because
right.
He doesn't doesn't just do it for 5 minutes. He claims it was for several hours, and after a few minutes, most people would say, okay,
that's enough.
This
right?
is enough. So he had this crazed element, and then Kim has this part later on near the end of the book where someone gets in a discussion with him about what kind of furniture could you make out of a sequoia, and he said, would you murder your own children or something to that effect?
Yeah.
You can see where you could have an interesting conversation and then suddenly say the wrong thing and find yourself. An element of fanaticism here, but endearing.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today about historic explorations of Alaska. We're bringing in the explorer part of our show's name as well as the outdoor part. And our main topic today is John Muir, who came to Alaska originally in the 1870s in a canoe and explored and made significant geographical discoveries and scientific discoveries, and then came back a number of times. There's a new book available by an Alaskan author, Kim Haycox, who has written many other books. This one is called John Muir and the Ice That Started a Fire. Kim is with us on the phone from Gustavus, and Talis Kohlberg, historian and director of the Mat-Su College, is in the studio. Talis is also got a very strong background in history of Alaska. So tell us about this canoe, Kim. Why would he choose to use a canoe? These are rough waters at times. And what was the canoe like? I mean, when I think about a canoe, I think about a aluminum canoe or perhaps a Coleman canoe. This is quite different from that, wasn't it?
Yes, this was a 35-foot long red cedar dugout canoe. And a red cedar is a light wood, so a bunch of people can move the canoe up and down a beach quite readily, and the whole act of carving a canoe, naming your canoe, possessing a canoe, even gifting a canoe, is a profound thing. When you live in it, like Talis was saying so beautifully just a little bit ago, it's a canoe culture. So sometimes we talk about the California car culture. Well, just magnify that maybe tenfold. The canoe culture was so profound among the Tlingit people of Southeast Alaska. Early white explorers would talk about the Tlingit and their canoes and how the children seemed to have been born with canoe paddles in their hands. I mean, so much was made about the canoe culture, moving around, going to your salmon streams in the fall to fish for coho salmon, for berry picking, for hunting. Everything was by canoe.
Where did he get the canoe, and how did he? Obviously, he couldn't paddle a 35-foot canoe by himself. Who were his companions?
His companions were four Tlingit Indians from the Stikine area.
Around Wrangell. Mm-hmm.
Fort Wrangell, right. Toyot, an 79-80-year-old man, was the chief. Kadashan and Sitka Charlie, and they moved up. He took along as well a Presbyterian missionary, S. Hall Young, who had arrived in Fort Wrangell only 1 year before, working for Sheldon Jackson. And they took off in mid-October 1879, the rainiest month of the year in Southeast Alaska, and they traveled about 850 miles in 40 days through October.
Wow.
And November. It's remarkable, really. It's one day after another of hypothermia weather, basically.
Right. Well, and we talk about explorers coming to Alaska in the late 19th century, and the word explorer is a little bit loaded, because, of course, there were already people here who had explored it and named every corner and crevice, and Muir made use of that knowledge, didn't he?
He did. He loved these Tlingits. He just thought they were so magnificent in how comfortable they were at sea in the canoe and on land, how knowledgeable they were, and they had great senses of humor. He did. He had great admiration for them. This trip, I believe, it changed his life.
The trip, I think, changed the life of S. Hall Young as well. He wrote a book, basically, just about, it's called Alaska Days with John Muir, and it's an element of hero worship of John Muir, a little bit of exaggeration, but it also is kind of fascinating when I read that book and then I read this book, and there's that part of this where, Kim, you touched on how Young felt it was one of the great thefts of history. Someone had tried to rename a glacier that had been named after him, and it's the business of naming things that Mr. Woolforth was just talking about is in itself a controversy. Who gets to name it and who gets to keep the name? But I found that humorous because I think this trip was the highlight of Young's life. Not only did he write a book about it, but seems to be focused on it.
Yeah.
And Muir basically tapped into what you'd have to say was something of the Presbyterian power structure in Southeast Alaska. There was Sheldon Jackson basically setting up a school system through the church and the government at the same time, and Brady becoming the Presbyterian governor and something of a rival to Young.
President Harrison was Sheldon Jackson's friend, right? And essentially got this.
There was several presidents that patronized, and of course presidents were making direct appointments of territorial governors at that time, so that there was whoever was a president, his party would be the party of the governor.
But not to get too far from the trip, Kim, you were talking about the fact that they were paddling around for 40 days in October in the rain, which would challenge anybody's gear now. How did these guys stay dry, and how did they... how did they function? I mean, I assume they just had wool and what kind of gear did they have to make it through that kind of wet, cold time period?
I've often wondered that, Charles. I mean, I think they are wearing wool, but honestly, in terms of what they're using to shed the rain, Pallas, do you have a better idea than I do? I don't really. They didn't speak in Hall Young's book, and in Muir's Travels in Alaska, I found no reference to clothing or gear. Did you?
I didn't see that, although I noticed that when he maybe misdirected Harriman to go for the bears in the valley where there were no bears, that they came back quite cold and tired. The references to the side trips, it had to be miserable at times.
Right, and the natives, of course, had their own gear. I don't know if Muir adopted any of that.
And they didn't always survive. There's a wonderful, sad, interesting, and inspiring story of a Lieutenant Heron up in the south central part of Alaska in the 1880s. I think he went from Susitna to explore and ended up in the Kuskokwim Valley, basically lost, and... There was a local native chief, Shishoi or something to that effect, who was hunting and shot a black bear and found in the black bear's stomach the remains of pork, which was not a normal thing he would find. So he's curious, and he traces the bear's steps backwards to where the bear had basically broken into the cache of Lieutenant Heron, who was at that point down and out, and by basically sleuthing and hunting and exploring, saves the life and basically rescues Lieutenant Heron, who was an explorer who basically had lost his way or ability to take care of himself. So it was dangerous and not easy to travel, even in the non-winter months.
There was no safety net. You were out there and the best you could hope for in most cases, I guess, is that the local natives would take in and take care of you. And so many great stories about that time period and just how adventurous it was.
And there was an element of hostility with natives as well. I mean, if you think about like Lieutenant Schwatka and the Army Expedition, his book, Summer in Alaska, basically... makes reference to the Koyukon Indians are the most dangerous, but a well-armed party can keep them at bay. And then you kind of read about Lieutenant Schwatka, and you realize he comes out of the time where he was part of the military expeditions in Montana and Wyoming that had resulted in Custer's Last Stand, for example. He was part of the cavalry units. He was trained to fight natives, and it's that time period, suspicion when the Russian explorer Zagorskin in 1842 went in interior Alaska. He references, that local natives were in a slight state of hostility toward each other, especially in the divide between the Eskimo and Athabascan areas, and that they were wary of each other. And so there was not only natural danger, but uncertainty about how you would be received.
Very much so in Southeast Alaska as well. I know that the military garrison there was often in fear. So, but I want to get into talking a little bit about the Glacier Bay, an extraordinary place, and that's where our guest Kim Haycox is. You were talking earlier about how there's this issue of naming things. Everything already has a name because natives have been there and have named it.
Right.
And so whites are coming in, and Harriman certainly was, when he came around the turn of the century with his expedition, he put names, some of them fanciful, all over the place. But Muir can be excused a little bit because he just kind of discovered Glacier Bay. I mean, it really hadn't been there before because of the melting of this ice. Is that true, Kim?
It's true. I mean, George Vancouver had dropped anchor near Glacier Bay in 1794 and sent Lieutenant Joseph Whidbey and three boats down Icy Strait, and they had seen this wall of ice in 1794 at the back of a bay that was maybe 5 miles deep at the time. And they thought, the British didn't really understand glaciation because they came from an island nation, a temperate, rainy, green island nation. And they thought when the British saw a wall of ice like that, they thought it was part of the polar plateau, stretched all the way perhaps from the Arctic and the North Pole. They had no idea how large alpine glaciers worked, that they could actually flow from the mountains down to the sea and calve ice into the sea. The French did understand this because they came from continental Europe and they had the Alps, and they knew better how glaciers worked. That's why all of our glacial terms today are largely French. Glacier, arête, moulin, crevasse. They gave us those terms, those names. But 85 years later, here comes John Muir with Whidbey's map, this crude map. And where the ice front was in 1794, now it's 35 miles farther back. And he's got one of his guides with him, the Tlingit guide, who had spent part of his youth in that country. And he didn't even recognize the country. It was so new.
Isn't that amazing? And that's what's so extraordinary about it even today, is it's a brand new bay.
It's sort of happening here, like with the retreat of Columbia Glacier and Prince William Sound. But even then, even today, not as drastically. I mean, these glaciers were retreating up to a mile per year.
Incredible.
Yeah, opening up this whole new land. And so Muir picked up in his canoe, Muir and Young and Toyot, they had with Toyot's permission, of course, he's the captain, a Huna Tlingit. They ran across a encampment of Huna Tlingit seal hunters, and they asked, would one of you come with us, please? We don't recognize any of this topography. We don't. And they thought, why at this time of year are you going up to look at these glaciers? They called him the Great Ice Chief, you know. So he was a very unusual guy.
Oh, my gosh. And October, November, any time of year, those glaciers, you freeze your tail off. But paddling around in a canoe in a wool coat, that sounds awful.
Here's an important point. And Talis, maybe you can pick up on this. Muir had charisma. I don't know about a lot of what you've read and know. You're so knowledgeable about other explorers in Alaska. But one thing that comes through again and again with Muir is that he had cross-cultural charisma, and it worked again and again for him.
And you brought that up beautifully with both his meetings with Emerson and Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, the fact that he could get the President of the United States to stop his schedule and go camp a couple nights spontaneously for the greatest moment, as you put it, in Roosevelt's life.
And they just sleep on the ground.
Which was a fantastic life.
I love that. I mean, imagine a president doing that today. You meet somebody he really likes. They ended up sleeping on the ground under the stars.
Although I do believe there's a story that one of the ways they enjoyed themselves was torching a dead tree just to see.
But
was something you wouldn't necessarily associate with their perspective anymore. But the glacier and its importance to Native Alaskans, I found that I have a book by Hank Young, and he's describing a Tlingit's description of the glacier, and there's just one sentence that kind of brings out the different perspective of what a glacier is. The cruel spirit of that glacier grew angry with me, I do not know why, and drove the ice mountain towards the sea and spoiled my salmon stream. So, I mean, there was a sense clearly in the local culture that the glacier had a mind of its own and was responsible and deliberate in its actions at times. So the retreat of the glacier must have been a fascinating concept when it was happening to the local people as they watched it go back and back and back.
So and the value of a salmon stream. Mm-hmm. A salmon stream is so important, especially if generationally, if your grandfather and your uncle, of course, who the males learn from, and the girls learn from their grandmothers, salmon streams, if they have been there through many generations and now the ice is marching over your salmon stream, that's very profound.
That's big news, yeah.
That's
so did Muir name Glacier Bay then?
He called it the Bay of Great Glaciers. How it got the name Glacier Bay Palace, do you know?
I do not know.
So, yeah, I think it might have gotten shortened to Glacier Bay, if I could guess, by Captain James Carroll, who brought some of the first steamboats up here, and he named Muir Glacier after Muir. Muir named a few sites in Glacier Bay, mostly after prominent geologists that James Geikie, Hugh Miller, that were important in his life as he was a student in his earlier years.
And his eyes were among the first human eyes to see the place, as he said, because the glacier had melted. And then he wrote about it, and very soon everyone in the world knew about it. He was already a popular writer, and he was spreading the news as he, you know, when he got back.
Right, there were already steamships running up and down, correct me on this, Talis, if I'm wrong, but running up and down through this inside passage from Tacoma, bringing down lumber, or I guess there wasn't a lot of timber cutting going on there, but delivering supplies and maybe gold from the Cassiar region back and forth. And then they realized, oh, there's a tourism potential after the writings of Muir. And beginning in 1883, 1884, they began to bring tourists up to the Inside Passage, with the final destination being Glacier Bay and Muir Glacier, this massive tidewater glacier that James Carroll called the eighth wonder of the world.
So it was his writing, Muir's writing, that really kicked off the tourism industry in Alaska.
Yes, it was, definitely.
And the White Pass Railway kind of made it expand further into the Atlin Lakes area there, where you got the combination of the ocean up the mountains into the lakes, and then they had boats on the lakes for tourists as well, and it was quite developed for a while.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation, and two fantastic guests who know so much about the subject. Talis Kohlberg, who is a historian and director of the Matsu College, and Kim Hickox, whose new book is John Muir and the Ice That Started a Fire. In the second half of the show, I want to continue to talk about Muir and his impact and how he traveled. He made more than one. We've only been talking really about this first expedition. He came later, traveling in different ways, and continue to have an impact. And then we're also going to talk about some of the other expeditions that came to Alaska in the 19th century. Alaska was an unmapped, unknown territory, and people had to come out and find out what was there so that that this new possession of the United States could be used. So that's all coming up in the second half of the show, and I hope you'll stick with us. But first, it's time for a break, and we're going to listen to a report by our producer, Monica Goki, who caught up with the daughter of Alaska whitewater kayaking legend, Dr. Embick. Embick logged countless first descents of Alaskan rivers, and his guidebook, Fast and Cold, is still the go-to resource for today's whitewater kayakers. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth.
Ask a paddler about early whitewater kayaking in Alaska, and chances are a guy named Andrew Embick will come up. He was known around his hometown of Valdez as Dr. Embick, a small-town physician with a big-time passion for the outdoors. Dr. Embick made leaps and bounds in exploring Alaska's rivers. Of the 80-odd rivers in his guidebook, Embick made first descents on more than a third of them. One of his daughters, Ellie Embick, who is actually also Dr. Embick after finishing med school last month, remembers seeing her dad's passion for exploration all over the family's living room.
He and his buddies spent hours and hours and hours looking at maps. We have about a foot-tall pile of maps of Alaska. I do remember them all being lined out on the table and looking at routes, and then getting chartered planes to fly over these rivers and try to determine whether or not they were runnable. And I spent countless hours doing that.
Dr. Embick's exploration in the 80s and 90s put Alaska on the map for whitewater kayaking before there were even a lot of kayakers in the state. For Embick himself, getting into kayaking was sort of uncanny to begin with. It was actually the mountaineering and the climbing that lured him north in the first place. But Alaska's a rainy place, and those mountains have rivers that flow down them. Kayaking was a natural transition.
Some of the first paddling he did was in the high school pool in Valdez. He and his buddy Chris Roach broke into the pool and taught themselves to roll out of a book.
Ellie remembers her dad's passion for the outdoors involving the whole family. They do trips together, and not just pokey car camping day trips with the babies. The Embicks would fly out into the Wrangles or into the Brooks Range for multi-day raft trips together. And that passion for the outdoors is something Ellie still carries with her. Kayaking has taken Ellie all over the world.
I mean, he's definitely the reason I got into kayaking. Without him, you know, I wouldn't have had the mentors and the equipment. But I actually got mostly into kayaking after he had passed away when I was 15. Getting into it was pretty meaningful for me at the time because it was something that he did, something that he excelled at.
These days, Ellie, too, is an amazing kayaker, a lot like her dad. And sometimes you can tell when you're paddling up to Ellie Embick on the river. Ellie's got a really different-looking helmet. It harkens back to an earlier era of kayaking, sort of like the whitewater kayaking equivalent of wearing bell-bottom jeans.
So when I first started boating, I decided I wanted to use his old helmet, which I actually still paddle with. It's probably made in the early 90s, late 80s, and says Embick across the front. And I still paddle with that as a sort of memento of him, and I say it's my good luck charm. Hopefully gives me some extra paddling skills.
For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Goki.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is historic expeditions, especially John Muir, who was such an important writer and scientist who came to Alaska originally in the 1870s and then came a number of other times, wrote about Alaska and made important discoveries here, publicized it, started the Alaska tourism industry, essentially, with his writings, and was really a giant in conservation and in the awareness of the need to protect natural places, someone that's perhaps forgotten in Alaska history because it came before the gold rush, and we tend to mark everything as starting with the gold rush in 1898, but a lot of interesting stuff was happening before. And also was such a tough guy. I mean, the fact that he could paddle for 40 days in October and November in southeast Alaska in a canoe and paddle around glaciers and make it home and write about it. Cold weather, and often on his journeys was short of food and lived pretty rough. And then later traveled in great luxury when the Harriman expedition came north around the turn of the century and brought a bunch of scientists and explorers to look at Alaska. So we're talking about these explorers, and two guests with me in the studio today. Kim Haycox is the author of John Muir and The Ice That Started a Fire. Kim is in Gustavus and coming to us by phone. And in the studio with me here in Anchorage is Talis Kohlberg, who is a historian and director of the Mat Su College. Talis, I wanted to set the let the listeners know about all the many explorations that were happening after the Alaska Purchase. There were expeditions quite different from Muir's, where military men and geographers were just trying to figure out what was here in Alaska, right? What were some of the first and most important of those expeditions?
Yeah, there were several, and it was part of the outgrowth of what was the actual governance of Alaska, because there was no real clear plan when the purchase. It didn't become a territory for quite a while, and it was this uncertain status. And so the United States Army sponsored several expeditions, perhaps the most famous being the Schwatka expedition, going from the Yukon Territory down the Yukon River, floating the river, and just kind of getting a sense of that. There were many smaller expeditions. There was the Allen expedition and the Glenn expeditions, kind of probing into the Copper River Basin. There was the Cantwell and Stoney expedition in the Kobuk River area up in northwest Alaska. There was Lieutenant Heron going into the Kuskokwim, and just the magnitude of the uncertainty was still evident even at the turn of the century, just as the gold rush was starting. And when the gold rush kicked in, there was a meeting with the surveyor in the Yukon, Mr. Dawson, George Dawson, for whom Dawson City is named, and the American government and the Canadian government basically said, I think it was $10,000 to try to just clarify where the border was, because they anticipated the mining claims would be crossing international boundaries. And there are maps from 1901. I have one at home that shows the Yukon-Kuskokwim connecting, literally. Someone just obviously connected dots because they were uncertain of what was there. And you can imagine where the idea of, you know, Seward's icebox comes from. Our glaciers tend to be concentrated on the tidewater areas near south-central Alaska, where people had the most contact. And until the gold rush, the non-native population was largely concentrated in the coastal areas, and there was a lot of uncertainty what was up there. And,
so maybe all the whole interior is nothing but ice.
The interior could be in 1896, Baloo's Alaska, a reputable tour guide for people traveling anywhere in the world, had this on page 259, that the former governor of the territory of Alaska himself had carefully investigated the subject of a huge species of animals believed to be representative of the supposedly extinct mammoth found in herds not far from the headwaters of the Snake River. So you have reputable travel guides telling tourists that if they're lucky, they'll see a mammoth herd in the center of Alaska, because people aren't certain that it's otherwise. So yeah, a lot of unknowns, even in 1896.
So how did these expeditions travel? You mentioned the Schwatka expedition. Did they go up the Yukon and build boats and float down? Or how did they, and how large was an expedition like that?
He had about 20 people, and it was basically a raft. Once the gold rush started, it became much clearer that there was basically a seaport at St. Michael where ships would come up and transfer to riverboats.
But I mean, for these first guys, they were completely out of contact with the outside world, and they had to completely take care of themselves.
Right.
Would they, like Lewis and Clark, of course, hunted to feed themselves. Did these expeditions live off the land at all?
Yeah, they very much were into hunting, and they were sometimes finding themselves, as I mentioned earlier, in dire straits, because they would underestimate things or overestimate what it would take to get to a certain place and what they would need. And you can only imagine if you step off a trail anywhere today, and if you go out and try to do just a beeline up a hill without a trail, how quickly it becomes a slow and arduous process, and a little ravine becomes a major obstacle.
Well, that's what one of the things that strikes me as extraordinary is that they have 20 men, and they're carrying a lot of gear, and they've got probably books and notebooks, and they're in a completely, essentially trackless place, and they have no map, and it's enormous in magnitude. It's a pretty daunting prospect. I mean, I think about,
it was high adventure, too. Yeah. You can see the attraction of it.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, how many of us get to explore a new place?
Carlos, I'm curious, any members of the military that would be on these expeditions with these leaders, could this really be prominent in their career? Was this very prestigious for them? I've read about the scientists and crewmen that got to accompany Robert Falcon Scott and Ernest Shackleton in Antarctica, for example. It was a huge sort of feather a boost. In their cap to have been on that expedition. Could the same be said of the members of these expeditions, early expeditions into Alaska?
You know, I don't know that they planned that from when it started, but it certainly turned them into minor celebrities. I mean, Schwatka became an author because of his travels, and it's hard to imagine that his career path before the explorations would have led him to become a sought-after author who was writing fairly popular books. It's like Henry Morton Stanley in the Congo. He goes from being a journalist to explorer to international celebrity because of his books. And you know, there was a huge market in the Western world for expeditions and journals of trips. This was high adventure.
Another thing that strikes me as interesting is this desire to see a mammoth or a mastodon. I remember, if I remember correctly, that Thomas Jefferson in 1806, when Meriwether Lewis reported to him late that year after their magnificent the Corps discovery back and forth across the United, what would be the future United States, I heard once that Jefferson was really hopeful that Lewis would tell him they had seen mastodons and mammoths.
And you can see in Monticello when you walk in the entryway that clearly was one of Jefferson's fascinations, is collecting anything about the artifacts of nature that are just littered all over that front entryway.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how long this process of exploring North America took, right? Yeah. That Jefferson got it started and it wasn't really completed, you might say, until the 20th century.
But Jefferson thought, Jefferson had the image, the vision to see the future United States as a continental nation, but he actually thought it would take up to 1,000 years for the continent to be developed on the West Coast as it was then on the East Coast.
Interesting.
And it took basically 50 to 70.
And that's what I liked about your book. You wrapped it into Frederick Jackson Turner's westward expansion theory, and there's a sequel to that in Alaska. As Orlando Miller wrote a book focusing on the Matanuska colony, but basically extrapolating and saying it went from east to west to north. And that was a natural progression of the American settling of the wilderness. There's another book by Bernard DeVoto called The Western Paradox, and I think it touches nicely on Muir's mindset and maybe represents the flip side of it. He has this quote in there that goes something like this. Lawlessness is the function of solitude, and I wonder what Muir would think of that, because clearly he sees solitude as something wonderful. But DeVoto, who was a conservationist and very very interested in preserving wilderness, saw small populations isolated as being uncontrolled and dangerous to the preservation of wilderness.
Interesting. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wilforth. I'm sorry, yeah. Kim. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wilforth, and we're talking about early explorers and expeditions that came to Alaska, primarily John Muir. And Talis Kohlberg, a historian, is in the studio, and Kim Haycox, whose new book about John Muir is on shelves now, is in Gustavus. Kim, one thing that we were just talking about is the rapidity of change after these first explorers came, and then the gold rush explodes across Alaska. In the course of his life, Muir came several times to Alaska, and the way he traveled and what he found changed as well, didn't it? I mean, when he came with the Harriman expedition, they were able to stop at various places and buy. They were on a steamer, and they could stop and buy stuff at different canneries, and it was much more developed than when he first came. True?
Yes, right. You figure that he made his first expedition 1879, and his last trip to Alaska was 1899, part of the Harriman expedition, which the railroad tycoon Edward H. Harriman financed the entire expedition and filled a steamship, the George W. Elder, with basically a who's who list of America's most prominent scientists, naturalists, artists, photographers, and Muir was among them. It was a grand expedition for 2 months during the summer of 1899. They covered 9,000 miles of the Alaska coast.
You pointed out the two Johnnies were on board.
The two Johnnies, John Muir and John Burroughs, yes, 1 year apart in age. And yeah, Talis, I mean, what do you think about that expedition standing out from the others? I think there's just even maybe in the history of the United States, is there anything else quite like it?
John Pierpont Morgan did, on a smaller scale, a similar expedition to the Holy Land, where he kind of populated it with prominent people, not nearly the number or size of this one. But I think there was... what fascinates me about... And you kind of underlined it when you juxtaposed the reality that, you know, here we are, Muir being very skeptical of the Gilded Age, but it's also the overlap of the Progressive Era, and you have both sides on the same ship.
That's what's always struck me, is what was it like at the dinner table? And Harriman wanted to go ashore and hunt, right? How did Muir feel about that?
Oh, he didn't like hunting at all, especially trophy hunting. I think Muir, having spent time with the Tlingits of Southeast Alaska, he could understand subsistence hunting. He could see that that's really quite noble. I loved it when he camped with Theodore Roosevelt in Yosemite, and Roosevelt talked him into eating an one-inch thick steak, you know, up on Granite Point that night. So I think Muir had a bit of a jaundiced eye for hunting, but he also, you know, Harriman wanted to shoot a bear. He wanted a trophy, and Muir thought was disgusted by that. But I think he had great admiration for a skilled hunter who's out there trying to feed himself and his family.
Mm-hmm. I think the wonderful passage that you put in your book kind of said a lot, and that was at the point where the Harrimans had decided they had seen far too much wilderness, and they faced their chairs out to the sea rather than the coastline because they just wanted to go home. What a contrast to Muir.
Right, yeah. And what a contrast in terms of how they traveled. I'm sure they had banquets every night as opposed to whatever food that he was able to carry along in his canoe the first time he came.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, about Muir, I think, that's significant, and you can't put a number on this, you can't quantify this, he was rapturous in the wilderness. He was on fire with passion for loving everything wild about him, and it just, he had that spiritual dimension to him, and that fed him, that sustained him. Writers like John Krakauer talk about mind over matter in mountaineering books. And I think that filled Muir's every minute and every hour that he was out there. And other people, too, I'm sure that many of these military expeditions, they knew their place in history. They could see it unfolding before them. People that know they are entering into a moment of history, Winston Churchill saying, "I was born for this." To lead England through the Second World War. You know, I think Muir knew that there was nobody else like him, and he was at the right place at the right time to really say something of great significance.
But it's interesting as well that's something that I think many of our listeners who are outdoors people identify with quite easily, is the spiritual dimension of being outdoors and being in beautiful places, and that the effort is part of it, and that the being in touch with the place you're in, and so not being, you know, not being on a big ship, but being in a kayak or a canoe is part of it. And there were writers before Muir, like, you know, Emerson and Thoreau, who tapped into that a little bit, but he was really the first Western writer and the inspiration for that entire worldview that we have now about what wilderness means.
Well, I think there's a possibly even a predecessor to it. I think William Cullen Bryant, when he wrote the poem Thanatopsis somewhere 1815, 1817, tapped into exactly what Muir found. You know, it goes something like,
poets.
"To him whom in the love of nature holds communion with her visible form, she speaks a various language. For his gayer hours, she has a voice of gladness, and for his darker musings, she glides in with mild and healing sympathy and steals away his sharpness air." That's, I think, a recognition pretty early on in the 1800s that was an incredibly popular sentiment and poem.
Right, and Shelley writing about the Alps and Mount Blanc. It's a good point, but I mean, Muir was such an important popularizer, and also I have the sense that some of this outdoor stuff that was happening in Europe was pretty civilized. You know, you climb Mount Blanc, but you end up hotel.
That's what Kim's book also brings out. He hated Europe, apparently, and I hadn't realized he'd been in Europe until I read this book, but he felt very stifled by that. But I have a question for Kim in this book, and that's, for a guy who was so determined to basically send a message about wilderness, why is it he never traveled with his family? Because he appears to be very close to his family when he's home, but over and over again, whether it's Alaska, Europe, Brazil, he's going without them. Do you have any insight into that?
I do a little bit, Cal. This is a great question. First of all, it was hard on his wife, Louie. She went with him once to Yosemite in 1884, just across the Central Valley, up into the mountains of the Sierra Nevada, and it was very hard on her. She was a homebody. She had a very comfortable, large home. She was the only daughter of a prosperous California fruit merchant, which John married into and you know, ran that business very assiduously for many years. So she, travel was hard on her. I don't think she liked to travel. Even to go from Martinez in the Northern Bay Area into San Francisco was unsavory to her. And the daughters, Wanda and Helen. Helen was always a little sickly. Travel was hard on her. John would worry terribly about any venture she might take very far from home. And both the daughters also, by the time John was done with his great travels, they were just finishing high school. So he was going overseas around the world and then down to South America and Africa, and they were still in their teenage years, right?
But where this came out to me was when you pointed out that on the Harriman expedition, he seemed to really click with the five children of the Harrimans, and I thought, where were his kids? Because that would have been a fairly easy trip for them if there was ever going to be a trip.
Yeah, good point, Talis. That's a really good point, and awesome. It's a pity those girls weren't along, because he loved children, and he was always, I like to think of John Muir was a half wondrous child, half wise elder, as he moved all through his days. That's what kept him so young. And I don't have an answer.
Maybe part of his dedicated
to stay home with their mother.
Don't you think part of his image as a writer, he became extraordinarily famous and very influential, was this loner image, this image of man out by himself in the top of a tree or exploring in a canoe, or that was part of what made him the sort of the romance that made his writing impactful. Would you agree with that?
I think that's his image, but at the same time, what came out in this book to me is he was close to his family, mm-hmm. and it just strikes me as that with a man with this central mission wouldn't involve the people. If he wasn't close to his family, it'd be easier, but it just seems odd that he would not bring them into at least some of this.
Right. I'm just thinking in terms of his impact as a writer and as a public figure. Was he that kind of figure, a nationally famous figure who is known for that kind of lone exploring, Kim?
No. When he went around the world, he went with his friend Charles Sprague Sargent, a professor of botany at Harvard University, and Sargent's son. So he wasn't in the beginning. They separated out from each other halfway through the trip. But I don't know if I had to really put my finger on why he chose to travel alone and without his daughters. His wife, I can answer pretty confidently. She was a homebody. Travel was hard on her. She honored the fact that John liked to go out and see the world and get reference points for his views on thinking and his such. But his daughters, he just adored his daughters, and they adored him. And why they wouldn't come along, my guess would be they felt more devoted to stay with their mom while she was without her husband, more so than John wanting to expand people's image of him as being the lone traveler. I don't think...
All right.
I don't know. I'm just guessing here.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We've got a few minutes left to talk about John Muir and early explorers of Alaska, what they accomplished and how they went about it, and kind of some of the mind-boggling things that they did without all the support and all the safety nets and all the modern equipment that we have. Kim Haycox is a author who's joining us from Gustavus, and his new book about John Muir is on shelves. And Talis Kohlberg is here in the studio with us. He's a historian and the director of the Mat-Su College. So what was the you talked a little bit, and I'm interested from both of you, maybe start with Kim, about the impact that Muir had in sort of starting tourism in Alaska. After people read his writings about Alaska, they started coming to just see it for themselves. Was there a broader impact on those writings with regard to Alaska? I mean, what was Muir's real legacy in terms of what he found here and what he wrote about?
His real legacy is the preservation of wild America, I believe. He was read by everybody. When Muir was young, were reading like William Wordsworth, and I don't know about John Keats and certain authors, but when Muir was older and soon after he passed away, many people were reading him. For example, Robert Marshall and Aldo Leopold talked about the writings of Muir, and Olaus Murie and Robert Sterling Yard, the guys that ended up creating the Wilderness Society in 1935. Olaus and Abe Murie, who became prominent in the creation of Mount McKinley National. Charles Sheldon, the guys in the Boone and Crockett Club, Teddy Roosevelt, George Bird Grinnell, they all knew and read John Muir. And so you get the Antiquities Act of 1906, so presidents can create national monuments with executive order. It's immeasurable, really, Muir's influence on the American conservation movement. He was hugely influential there.
And many of those people that you mentioned who he inspired had a huge impact on Alaska and were sort of founding figures of conservation in Alaska. But interestingly, his writing is maybe not read that much anymore. I mean, it's the style of it is somewhat Victorian and verbose and maybe a little overly flowery. Some writers who he inspired, like you mentioned, Aldo Leopold, we still do read, but I'm not sure that many people still read Muir's original works.
I've heard that one of his most widely read books still is Travels in Alaska, because approximately 1 million people travel to Alaska each year, many of them on cruise ships, and moving up into the interior to Denali National Park and the Kenai Peninsula, even all the way up to Dead Horse and Kotzebue and Nome, and that Travels in Alaska still sells briskly every summer. It's recommended by different book organizations and such, and that was the book that, in many respects, meant the most to John Muir. It's the book he put off till last and finished just before his death on Christmas Eve, 1914.
Hmm. What do you still read his stuff, Talis?
I mean, I do. I enjoy reading, and I enjoy that type of book. I think that one of the side stories that Kim also touched on in his book was not only emergence of the Wilderness Society, but the schism in what it seems like, was it a necessary split? The more practical mixed uses of mm-hmm. Gifford Pinchot and Theodore Roosevelt and even that impact even in Alaska and the development of the Cordova area and the coal mines there is, should it be total preservation as opposed to mixed use?
A controversy which it helped really give birth to Anchorage, as I've been working on a history of Anchorage for our centennial, that this conservation controversy that involved Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot and through our history. And unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, I was going to say, his Crater Lake mentioning in this book was wonderful, where they just wouldn't talk to the fellow anymore because he was going to allow sheep herding in Crater Lake, and Muir said that was beyond the pale.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks, gentlemen. This was a fascinating hour, and I enjoyed it very much. And I do recommend Kim Haycox's new book, John Muir and the Ice That Started a Fire, which is out from Lions Press. And Talis Kohlberg was kind enough to come in from the Valley to talk with us today.
It was a wonderful book, and thank you for the invitation.
Oh, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Talis.
On our next show, we're talking about minimizing your impact when you're outdoors. You've heard the old adage, take only pictures, leave only footprints. Well, how do you go about doing that? We'll be talking about it next week. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.